For over 10,000 years, much of humankind has lived inside walls, or behind walls, behind still more walls. Walls have protected us and divided us, but have they also affected the way we think, work, and create? David Frye's new book, Walls, A History of Civilization in Blood and Brick, is a narrative of invasions, empires, kings, and cons, presenting a new theory. Walls haven't just influenced the course of history, they have profoundly shaped the human psyche. David Frye currently teaches ancient and medieval history at Eastern Connecticut State University. His new book is Walls, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. It's great to be here.
So I'm only assuming, I have no idea, you've been working on this, and this has been a part of your life, looking at walls, and of course, understanding history and medieval history. But given the current discussion in the world, I assume it dawned on you that, oh yes, it would make sense to write a book about walls.
That's exactly right. I'd been kicking around the idea for a while, actually, Joe. I had been working on another project, which was not specifically about walls, but it kept leading me to walls. And I was finding walls all around the world. You know, I was finding them obviously in China, but also in so many other countries, Iran, Iraq, Bulgaria, Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, Ukraine. You know, so many countries had built these walls. And what I observed and what really surprised me was that there really hadn't been any general work done on them, that there weren't any general histories, which is astonishing because, you know, you could go to your library and you could pick up a history of water, you could pick up a history of the number zero or the number pi, dozens of histories of chocolate, but no history of these walls that tens of millions of people labored to build, that hundreds of millions of people lived behind. And so, yeah, the idea was back there in my mind, and then all these controversies erupted, you know, really beginning in 2015, and I decided that was the last prodding I needed to really get started on this, that, you know, this is the moment. If you're ever going to do it, you should do it now.
Right. Is it safe to say that in most cases, and your book goes back thousands and thousands of years, mm-hmm. is it safe to say that in most cases, the wall is built to keep someone or something out?
Absolutely. In fact, Joe, that would be close to 100% of cases. I mean, there's a few rare exceptions, as long as we're not getting down to the very nitty-gritty like prison
right.
walls.
Sure.
But there are, you know, some rare exceptions like the Warsaw Ghetto and the Berlin Wall. But for the most part, walls have been intended to keep people out of a given territory.
And overall, does that concept work? Does it actually do what it's supposed to do?
Yeah, I guess what I would say, I think the formula would be this, that guarded walls work, unguarded walls don't. And in saying that, you know, I do have to give the caveat that I am combining two different types of walls in my evidence. You know, there's the sort of early walls that were built for thousands of years, which were military in nature, and they were intended to keep armies from invading. And then there are the modern walls, many of which don't take the form of a proper wall, but they're more like border barriers of various sorts with various technologies attached to them. But in both cases, I think you can generally say that, yeah, they carry out their assigned task as long as they're constantly staffed, as long as they're constantly guarded, you know, by loyal and uncorrupt guards. I guess you could throw that in as well.
The way you have sectioned the book is there are several parts to it, four ultimately. Mm-hmm. The first part being mm-hmm. builders and barbarians, and mm-hmm. then the second part being the age of great walls. So mm-hmm. what brought us to that age of great walls?
Well, so prior to that, you had thousands of walls, but most of them were city walls. You know, it's something that it's easy to forget that a city was once a thing that had a wall going around it. So that, you know, if you drove into Albany, you know, you'd have to pass through gates to get into Albany. But then as these enormous imperial states developed, they began to build, you know, what we might refer to as great walls. You know, happened, you know, in China, happened with the Roman Empire. The Sassanid Persians became great wall builders. And there were smaller states as well. There were kingdoms that had started doing that prior to this great age. But it was really the rise of the empires that made that, you know, made that, that period possible.
Is a fence a wall?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think in modern parlance, you wouldn't say that because, you know, the word wall has sort of become a dirty word after Berlin. That being said, when I get to the more contemporary evidence at the end of the book, I am lumping in all sorts of, you know, barriers that might be, you know, more classified as fences. I'm lumping those into the evidence because I think functionally they're very similar. And in some cases, they can be every bit as difficult to breach as an actual wall.
You make the point in the book, and I think it's an interesting one, which is who were the wall builders? And while that is a good question, which you address in the book, interestingly, that really didn't come up in conversation and wasn't really asked till very late in the process, in the timeline.
Right. That's right. That's right. I mean, it's... I guess that one of the issues there, Joe, is that people were building walls before we could even hear their conversations. So, you know, the earliest real wall that we know of, like a defensive wall, would have been built in the Jericho, the famous city of the Bible. And that's going back to the 10th millennium BC. So, you know, that's about as prehistoric as we get. You know, we don't have any written sources to know. You know, is there any conversation going on about these walls, or is any debate going on about these walls? And I guess as a historian, we're always, especially a historian of ancient history, you're always confronted with this issue of, you know, how much can we pull out of the sources? And part of that may just be a reflection of, you know, we have so much more written from modern times than we do from earlier historical periods.
Fairly early in the book, you write a sentence that is, the desire for walls is not innate to the species. The need for security is.
That's right. That's right.
That says a lot about us that we have these split human societies, right?
Right, and they address the need for security in completely different ways. You know, I don't know if you've heard of the psychiatrist Maslow and his hierarchy of needs, and he sort of laid out these are the things that, you know, a sort of a human being needs, and you know, you need food and you need shelter, and then, you know, right there at the bottom of the pyramid, he has this security. And frankly, I've thought about it a little, and I wonder if security ought to be at the bottom, because I wonder, you know, if you would finish your hamburger and milkshake if you were under attack, right? You know, so right. Maybe security should be right there at the top. But how do communities address this question of security? And one of the things I discovered in my research in looking at the ancient evidence is that you have, on the one hand, communities of people who come to define themselves as workers, and so they do work to create security. They stack bricks, they move stones, and they tamp earth down so that it's really hard, and they create these walls which they hope will work as a 24/7 security system. But you mentioned that there were, you know, there were sort of these two types, and that's absolutely true, that you have on other cultures, other societies, where you have people out there and they're living in an unwalled world. And typically, almost invariably in those worlds, every man became a warrior. He was raised from essentially childbirth to endure pain and to be skilled in weapons. And in those cultures, the measure of a man was his skill in battle. And it was just another way of addressing the need to, for security. And so those two different types of societies developed in parallel for most of human history.
You mentioned Maslow, and you write about it in the book, in that hierarchy mm-hmm. of needs, of that need for security. You also talk about, but then what? So what? Once you achieve that security, then in that hierarchy, it is
right.
You're going for self-actualization. Okay.
Yeah. According to Maslow, but yeah.
Right.
Sure.
If they mm-hmm. achieve security, then what was mm-hmm. the next mm-hmm. level?
What was the next level is what fills our history books to this day. It was in fact the people behind the city walls who were, writing plays and, developing philosophies, working out mathematical problems, that given that security, they did in fact move up, that hierarchy of needs that Maslow created, and they started doing things that they couldn't have done if they were spending all their time training with weapons, remaining constantly on alert for invasion. So it's interesting that it's sort of a turning point in all these ancient societies when they first start building walls, and that tends to be the beginning of so many other things.
So there's a point, and you don't have to get overtly political, but I will. Which is
okay.
but it just
thank you for giving me that out, Joe.
Well, it just seems that when you look at a proposal that says we're going to build a wall to keep an entire country and its people out, that
right.
my initial
or numerous countries, actually.
Numerous
yeah.
countries, that my response yeah. is, oh my God, we're going back to the Dark Ages. I don't read
okay.
anything
yeah.
in your book that doesn't really say, yeah, you're going back to the Dark Ages.
Well, it's because I'm trying to take a neutral position throughout the book, because I think that's the only way you can honestly approach history. I mean, certainly you can start with a political position and then cherry pick examples from history to confirm it. My real focus was frankly on the history. It just interested me so much to be able to describe what had happened in the past. And I'm happy to let other people lecture on, what the best thing to do is in contemporary politics. But I didn't really choose to go in that direction.
I understand that. However, when you talk about you mentioned early on in our conversation about the more contemporary. And so
mm-hmm.
at
yeah.
the beginning of the book, I mean, there's 200 pages before we even get to like the mid-1800s. So, I mean,
right,
after
sure.
that, the fourth part of the book is a clash of symbols. So what is that clash,
sure.
and is that ultimately what we're seeing now?
I think so. When we're arguing about any sort of political issue, we tend to argue it in shorthand, and symbols become very important in debates. And that's what I'm... I guess I'm not really trying to weigh in on the debate at the end of the book, but I'm trying to describe how some of these symbols became such an important part of our consciousness, and in particular how certain walls, and I got to say one in particular, became very important in shaping our thinking about walls and borders in general.
When it comes to that history, should we be how much do you think this history should be a part of the conversation that we're having right now? I mean, we're talking about money. We're talking about how we fund
right.
it. We're talking about immigration, of course. I mean, all of these are important issues, understood. But
mm-hmm.
should we also be talking about the history?
You know, Joe, I don't want to drive away book buyers, but I don't think that we necessarily need to be looking at ancient history in order to, and the book's, as you say, not entirely ancient history, but I don't think it's the only guide. There are so many important factors that need to be weighed on, a very important decision like that. And I think history is just a part of the broader picture you know, I think everyone should be educated in history. And I think this is an important part of our history where we really haven't been educated. But I certainly don't think it should be, you know, the sole factor or perhaps even the biggest factor in you know, in our minds when we're talking about politics.
But in reality, where mm-hmm. if built as described, where would this rank in among the walls that we have seen in our history?
You know, I know, you know, in terms of, you know, let me start with numbers a little bit in terms of size. You know, I mean, so many bigger ones have already been constructed. I mean, for example, the estimates on the Great Wall of China, you know, believe it or not, Joe, we don't know where it ended exactly to this very day. But, you know, some people have estimated as many as 10,000 miles long. But even compared to contemporary walls, you know, India has thousands of miles of barriers around it right now, you know, snaking through the Himalayas. And Saudi Arabia is more or less entirely surrounded by walls. Israel, you know, you're an educated guy. I think you know Israel's a tiny state, but right. You know, it's got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of long walls around its borders just because the borders are not straight. And you know, once you start sort of snaking around in certain, so you know, in terms of ranking, you know, in terms of size, it wouldn't be quite the monumental achievement that people might think it was. You know, it's a little bit more commonplace than people realize. You know, if I could, you know, add to that just a little bit more.
Sure.
You're saying, you know, if it's built, you know, where would it rank? I think that one thing that people often miss when they're debating this, you know, we tend to want to see it as a debate between a wall and open borders, and I doubt that's the way it plays out. Now, you know, as a historian, I'm much better at descriptive than prescriptive. You know, I'm not a fortune teller, but I suspect that there will be walls. I do think history tells us that there will be walls. The question is whether there will be, you know, sort of a great big wall that's intended to protect an entire nation, or whether there will be thousands and, in fact, tens of thousands of little walls protecting the neighborhoods and homes of the wealthy, because we're also seeing that going on throughout the world.
And I thought that was such an interesting part of the book. It's mm-hmm. very much at the end of the book, but you talk about these gated communities. I mean, you look at
right.
what's happening in
That's
California,
right.
and all over the country, really,
mm-hmm.
of people. You use the California reference of the rich and famous, but all over, people
mm-hmm.
want
right.
to be, they want that security. They want to be gated in. And then, of course, we could even go a step further of just psychologically the walls that we put up to keep us away
yes.
from other
yes.
people.
Yes. After I wrote the book, I coined the phrase micro walls for all these. It's too, you know, you're not going to find it in there anywhere. I came up with it too late, sort of like, you know, when you walk away from a party and you suddenly realize that funny rejoinder
right.
you should have made.
That great quip. Right.
Exactly. But yeah, I'll give you an example. I was at a little meeting with some of my colleagues just the other night, and one of them, who makes frequent trips to Brazil, was describing how Brazil is just filled with these micro walls. That, you know, the condo communities are all walled. The high rise communities have walls going around them. Neighborhoods have walls going around them. Homes have walls going around them. And she was telling me that. About a popular song down there where the singer has this part of the lyric is that the singer has this plaintive wish for a home without walls. So the micro walls are happening. And that's why I say I'm not sure it's really an issue of open borders versus a big wall. It's so much a big wall versus micro walls.
And it seems a safe bet that in some way, shape, or form, there will always be some sort of wall around us.
Yeah, Even as you know, you brought up the concept that you know there are all these metaphorical walls, right? They're psychological walls, and I suspect they will always be there.
The book is fascinating. It is entitled "Walls: A History of Civilization in Blood and Brick," and the book is published by Scribner. David Fry, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you, Joe. It was great.
Again, the name of the book is "Walls: A History of Civilization in Blood and Brick," published by Scribner, by David Fry. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.